The holidays are already in full swing. The lights are up, you got good people, good food, and good vibes. And there to help keep that energy going is Sprite Winter Spice Cranberry. With that crisp cranberry flavor with a smooth winter spice twist. It's the drink that livens up game nights, gift exchanges, or just catching up in the kitchen with a burst of holiday flavor. It's a seasonal favorite, but it's only here for a limited time. So grab it while you can. Sprite Winter Spice Cranberry. Sprite. Obey your thirst.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. RocketMoney.com/cancel.
Support for today's episode of Truth and Justice comes from the ABC Network's new weekly drama series, Conviction. Each year in America, thousands of people are wrongfully convicted. That's why the Conviction Integrity Unit was assembled. Follow the investigations of this elite team who have only 5 days to determine if the seemingly innocent should be set free. Inspired by real events and from the executive producer of Criminal Minds, Conviction stars Haley Atwell and premieres Monday, October 3rd at 10, 9 Central on ABC. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I'm your host, Bob Ruff, and in this week's episode, I'm calling upon the Truth and Justice Army to help me try to wrap my brain around this Leonard Mosley interview. One of the disadvantages of working alone is I have no one here to bounce ideas off of or have a discussion with. It's been about 2 weeks since I recorded the interview with Mr. Mosley, and every time I re-listen to it, I keep flip-flopping back and forth as to whether I believe he was telling the truth or if he was lying to me. This week, I've received more emails and tweets and Facebook comments and messages than I have in the last 5 weeks combined. So this seemed like a perfect opportunity to get you on the phone with me where we can discuss this interview. I want to hear your thoughts and theories and ideas and questions. So in just a few minutes, the phone lines are going to open up and you're going to hear other listeners just like you and hear their comments on the interview. Today's episode will also be a good preview as to what's to come in November when we start producing the second episode per week. Starting in the first week of November, I'll be dropping a second episode on either Thursdays or Fridays, where I'll be taking calls and getting feedback from you and having discussions with you, the listeners, about that week's episode. Now, as far as the Leonard Mosley interview is concerned, I'm not stopping here. I've been in contact with Jim Clementi. You all know Jim. Jim is the retired supervisory special agent from the FBI's Behavior Analysis Unit. He's also a writer on Criminal Minds. He was, I believe, the executive producer of the Case of JonBenet Ramsey TV show last week. And of course, he's also one of the hosts of one of my favorite podcasts, Real Crime Profile, along with Laura Richards and Lisa Zambetti. Jim is helping to put me in contact with a couple of people that I think may be able to help us out. Normally, this is the type of thing I would have Jim review for me, but Jim listens to the show and he's very familiar with the case. And I want somebody with an unbiased ear to listen to Leonard Mosley's interview. Jim is putting me in contact with Jim Fitzgerald, who's also retired from the FBI and is a linguistic analyst. He also appeared on the Case of JonBenet Ramsey. And also Jim is putting me in contact with a statement analysis expert, Mr. Stanley Burke. So hopefully we'll be able to get all of our schedules in order, and one or both of those gentlemen will be able to listen to the interview and then come on the show and give us their analysis. But for now, for this week, let's get right into your calls. All right, I've got Sonny Levine on the phone from sunny California. How you doing today, Sonny?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I'm great. So Mike tells me that you have an analysis of the interview for us to go over.
Well, one of the things, I listened to it about three times. I took about six pages of notes and then revised it because originally I know I said I had like 20-something things to go over. But, I mean, for the interest of time, I wanted to narrow it down to a few key things. When I was first listening to it, during the interview, you had said that he mentioned that she had been choked four times. And it was true. I agreed with you. It seemed a little forced, almost like he was waiting for you to correct him. And when I went through it, I started from the beginning. One of the first things I noticed right away is that he always deflects everything from himself. And okay. He contradicts himself a lot. To start, right when you brought it up, first thing you said it was Margie because she shoots people. The problem with that is that she wasn't shot. She was strangled and she had her throat slit.
Right.
And if he thinks it's Margie, then he contradicts himself again because the whole reason he doesn't think it's Francis, is because he's not strong enough, he's weak, he's short, all that kind of stuff. So that was one of the first things I noticed.
Yeah, I noticed too with the, I thought kind of the same thing about Margie, you know, when he was saying that it was her, she's dangerous, she's violent, she shot her husband. He said she shot my brother and then she shot and killed his other brother, which I'm not aware of the other brother shooting. And then shot her son. All I was thinking was, it sounds like if Margie does have a violence issue, that her MO is with a gun and not with a knife.
Yeah. And to me, aside from it being pointless, I just felt like he tried to make him the victim and a hero after the fact when he said he would have shot her, he should have shot her when she pointed a gun at him. That just seemed like a distraction. Another thing that he did that was a contradiction was he did this a couple of times when you interviewed him, and I think he caught himself because he did his nervous laugh a few times. But he had said he knew that Ed was helping Elnora around the house. And then like 2 seconds later, he said if he had known he was helping, he would have told her it was a bad idea. Again, he's the hero and he's contradicting himself.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of them. I'm not trying to take up all your time because I know we got a ton of great listeners. Another thing which you pointed out too, and I caught it, he said he was calling to let her know that he wouldn't make it over that night, which is his alibi. Problem is, the message he left that he would. So there's a lie. Again, he contradicts himself.
And did you catch too? Did you catch too that he seemed to confirm to me that he did leave a message saying he was coming over that night?
Exactly. Yeah. But the thing is, he's such a terrible liar. He's just a bad liar. And I caught several things. But then beyond that, if he was only calling to say that he wasn't going to make it, why did he need to call all day?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, what he told me was that she wasn't picking up, so he kept trying over and over again. So I guess I kind of see that if that was the case, but you know, he didn't at trial. He actually specifically stated that he never called her and told her that he wasn't coming, and he didn't drive by or stop by or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that makes me think of is, you know, he made it a point to say we were going to get married. Well, if you were going to get married, then that means you care about her. You must love her. If she wasn't picking up and you've been trying to reach her all day, why didn't you just stop by after work?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, especially considering she only lives, you know, she lives about, you know, I made the drive. It's maybe 10 minutes away, you know, and if you know that she's got a meal on the stove for you, then why, you know, why not at least swing by and eat the meal and then go home? I don't buy it.
Well, not only that, but if she's got a meal on the stove and in the bedroom, you might want to go by.
Right.
Yeah. Another way he contradicted himself, again, this was in a matter of seconds in the interview. He says, I called her in the morning. And then, like, right after that, he says, oh, I called her around 3:30. Make up your mind. You know, let me go through some other stuff here real quick. Oh, another thing that stood out real strong to me was he said that when he got there, the police immediately told him that they found his semen that matched him. My question is, how the hell would they have anything that matched him if they had yet to collect his blood?
Yeah, I noticed that in that part of the interview, he seemed to be kind of waffling a little bit. He seemed very uncomfortable to me in that part of the interview because he was kind of time warp jumping back and forth and back and forth. I assume that he meant at some point they told him that. I mean, because obviously they couldn't have known that at that time. So I'm not sure what to make of that.
Oh, another big thing that you caught him in. And he did another slap on this one. I'm sure you caught it too. He, when you guys were going over, he had mentioned her being choked and you're like, oh, she was choked. And then he says, well, yeah. And then he gets into, well, he says, I got off work at 11. And then you told him, well, she was killed at 11:30. And then immediately right after that, he repeats himself. And then he says, well, I got off work at 11:30, like within a matter of seconds. As soon as you said what time she got killed, that's when you decided you wanted to say instead of 11 when he got off work, he got off at 11:30. That was another big thing I noticed.
Yeah. And there was, you know, some of that didn't bother me as much only because I actually know that he doesn't get there until his testimony anyway, and Angela's testimony was that he gets off at 11, he takes a shower, and then he mm-hmm. makes about a 25-minute drive down there, so he wouldn't be there till after midnight anyway. And I intentionally, when I told him, oh, we know she was killed around 11:30, obviously we don't know her cause of death, but I just said that to see, I kind of plopped it right in the middle of his kind of timeline there between getting off work and getting there just to kind of see what he said. And yeah, and he did kind of bounce from 11 to 11:30. And then I think at one point he says, well, yeah, I mean, well, even then, you know, I get off, I take a shower, I drive there. I wouldn't get there till like 12.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that was kind of, I don't want to say funny, but it was just kind of, it just kind of went along with the theme of his BS was, you asked him a simple question and he struggled. He didn't even answer it. He was too busy trying to make the dates work. And that was, when was your son born? He couldn't answer it. He was too busy trying to figure out the date.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it's innocent, but I'm sure I could ask you right now when your sons were born and you'd be able to tell me.
Yeah.
Why
for sure.
Why is he too busy?
Yeah. And again, the biggest issue that I had with Mosley, and I'll let you go right for this, Sonny, so we can take some other calls, but. You know, the biggest issue that I have is I don't have a baseline for him. You know, I don't know what's his memory normally like. Was he a good father, an involved mm-hmm. father, or was he, you know, just a guy who was kind of mailing it in, literally a check every month? And, you know, it's hard to tell with things like that. You know, was he not remembering his son's birthday because he was distracted by all the other stuff? Or is he a guy that, mm-hmm. you know, if anybody asked him when his son was born and he wouldn't really know. I have no way of really, really knowing that. But hey, Sonny, thanks for calling in, man. It's good to, you know, this, I think it's the first time I've ever actually talked to you.
I did have one more quick thing I wanted to say.
Okay.
And that is, you had mentioned before you didn't understand why people wanted to meet you. And I'll tell you why. The reason why, there's three reasons. One is you make people feel important. You know, a lot of times people just go through the regular 9-to-5 and, you know, that's it. They're stuck in a routine. So you make people feel important. You make people feel involved. But then you also make people feel like they're making a difference. So there's your answers.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Sonny. I appreciate that. And thanks for calling in, buddy.
Take it easy.
Yep.
Go Noles.
Bye. All right. I've got, Michael from Dallas calling from Louisiana. How you doing today, Michael?
I'm doing fine, Bob. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Mike tells me that you pass through Tyler on your commute every week.
Yeah. I'm coming over here to run this hospital in Louisiana, and every time I pass through Smith County, I'm just like, this brings up all the memories from your season two. It's just really appreciate the work that you're doing there.
Oh, thanks, Michael. I appreciate it. So Mike tells me you have a couple questions for me. What's your first question?
Yeah, it's pretty basic. I'm just wondering with Mr. Mosley's, you know, either legitimately not knowing about Lenore's throat being cut or acting like he doesn't. I'm wondering if you had uncovered anything in trial testimony, or do we know where he was getting his information from and why he wouldn't legitimately know that her throat was cut? Do we have any evidence that shows that, you know, he was privy to that information? That's kind of the first part of my question. And then the other part is just if we were to show that he, you know, he should have known or he did know, what is the benefit to him of not acting like he doesn't know that her throat was cut? And it just kind of reminds me of a little bit of the Ned Non-Sayed case where Jen and Jay always stuck to this one phone call. They never wavered from that in all the versions of their story, and maybe there's some legitimate reason why they never wavered. And I'm wondering if it's like some benefit to him to not know that her throat was cut. So that's kind of my little two-part question.
Okay. To answer your first question, at this point, I do not know for certain one way or the other if he did actually know that her throat was cut. I should know soon. And actually, this is the first time announcing this is to you here on the air. I just got back 2 days ago my ruling from the Attorney General with the Smith County trying to stop me from getting those records. And the Attorney General basically mm-hmm. wrote them back and said, knock it off and give it to him. You got 10 days.
Yes.
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 And so part of that request for me was his interviews, his written statements, his conversations with the defense investigators. So I'll have a better idea to be able to tell in a more certain fashion what he did know and didn't know. Circumstantially looking at it, I can't say one way or the other, but it just looks, it would be so odd to me for him not to know. I mean, you have Johnny Pryor, who found the body, noted that there was blood all over the place. Kubia Jackson knew that her throat was slit. These are all people that he knows and talks to on a regular basis. You have the fact that he says he talks to her sister. Her whole family, her sister, her kids, all came to the house that next morning and then helped clean the house out. Well, there was obviously, there was a mess. There was blood all over the floor. You know, there's all these things that had to be cleaned up. You know, this was reported in the media. You know, he went through both of these trials. And then when I compare that to the other elements of the crime that he did seem to know, you know, when he knows that the seat was pushed all the way back and he knows that the car was pulled all the way around back, things like that.
Right.
It's like, how does he know all these details and doesn't know the other? And then we have, you know, the defense investigator, Tim Lowndes, says that when he interviewed him, he said that he thought he was a suspect because he had intimate details. He knew the position of the body, the layout of the crime scene. Now, he does not say in there that he knew the cause of death. So we won't have that answer until I get this open records request back, and then hopefully we will. As far as the second part of your question, as why would he lie about it, I don't necessarily think if he's lying, and like I said before, I'm not bullshitting about this. I honestly don't know whether he was telling the truth or not at this point. I'm still kind of baffled by it.
Right.
But if he was, I think the motivation for doing that is simple. I mean, it would be, if he's lying, then we're dealing with a sociopath, you know, which, you know, obviously, assuming he was guilty, or let's say that he was guilty, it's someone who brutally murdered this woman, fled the scene, and then allowed somebody else to go to prison for the crime that he committed. You know, a guy who's married with a child and a child on the way. So it fits kind of both ways. So, because if he is the guilty party, in order for someone to do those things, and then you can even go back even further, the fact that, you know, he has two different women, both Elnora and Angela Walker, who both think that they're in a very committed relationship with him when clearly he's playing them both. You know, these are all indicators of a sociopath, you know, and I'm not, of course, a clinical psychologist. I'm not diagnosing him, but there's certainly indicators of that. And so then when we go back to him telling me in a pretty convincing way that he doesn't know what the cause of death is, it fits with that behavior. You know, somebody who has those sociopathic tendencies tend to be very manipulative. They tend to be very good liars. And I think that the purpose behind that for him, it would be very simply just throw me off the track, you know, knowing if he knows that I'm the one who's investigating, you know, if he put two and two together between Francis's brother telling him that I had come by and decided to, you know, I'm going to go ahead and talk to him. But if I can just act like I don't know what the cause of death was, that will certainly throw him off the track, which it did. I mean, it does. How could he be the killer if he didn't know? So I think it's as simple as that. I can't see any other motivation other than just to try to get me to believe that he doesn't know the cause of death and therefore back off of him as a suspect.
Yeah, I guess it could just be that simple. I was thinking maybe there was like some reason why he was specifically acknowledging that he knew that she was strangled, but not that she was stabbed. I didn't know if there was something forensically that was advantageous to that or whatever, but it sounds like it could just be, if indeed the hypothesis were to be true that he's, you know, manipulating, then I guess it could be that simple. It's just a simple, really a tactic just to kind of throw you off the scent, I guess.
Yeah. And I have had it suggested to me by a few listeners that have emailed in and said that what if he was there, had the argument with her and choked her and left and thought she was dead, and someone else came in later and killed her, which, I mean, would be pretty hell of a bad night, but that's something else that's been thrown around, is that he thought he killed her by strangling her, and someone else finished the job.
That's interesting.
Yep. So, all right. Well, anyway, I want to thank you for calling in, Michael. It's good to hear from you, and give Tyler a salute on your drive by next week.
Yes, sir. Congratulations on getting that ruling.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Michael. Have a great day.
All right. Have a good one. Bye.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
All right, I'm on the air with Kimberly from the United Kingdom. How are you doing today, Kimberly?
Hi, Bob. It's a fantastic show, and I really applaud you for all your amazing effort.
Thank you for that. It must be late in the UK right now.
It is. Yes, it's 12:30 in the evening.
All right. Well, we'll get right to your points before we let you get to bed at some point here. Mike tells me you have four points.
That'd be fantastic. I'm calling because there's two things Leonard Mosley said and two things he didn't say, which really bother me.
Mm-hmm.
So first of the things that he said, there's a lot of really casual misogyny, which I find worrying. So he said, women, you know what women are like. You know how women are. They take your personal stuff. And given that this is a crime against women, these kind of casual comments suggesting, oh, well, yeah, all women will get mad and shoot you and want to get pregnant by you and take your stuff, I find very disturbing. I also find disturbing his casual assertion that he had no idea what happened inside the trailer, didn't know how she died, didn't know the phone was ripped off the wall, not just for the reasons that you said in the episode on Sunday, but when someone dies under the age of 50, it's a shocking event. And this is not like Aleppo or another extreme circumstance where people are just dying everywhere. It would just be natural curiosity to find out why someone that you were thinking about marrying died. And it's not like the details were difficult to find. So effectively, he's saying, yeah, she died, and I just didn't give a toss to find out why. That doesn't sound like someone that you plan to marry. That doesn't sit right with me.
Sure.
Now, the things that he didn't say, the first thing is there's a complete lack of concern for Elnora. He was supposedly this great friend, and he was even thinking about marrying her, and then he casually lets things slide like, well, yeah, that meal was for me, and I tried to call her, and she made it anyway. No big deal. But you would have thought, if you were completely innocent in this situation, that you'd be like, man, she made that meal for me, and it just bothers me that that's the last normal thing she did, and then this monster got her. And at the end of your conversation with him, where he's, yeah, that's awful that the prosecutor should be in jail, and yeah, they should convict innocent people, that's a waste of taxpayer money. Okay, those are fair points, and I agree with him about the prosecutor going to prison, but you would have thought that as a close associate of the victim, that your first reaction would be, oh, man, those prosecutors' further dishonored Elnora. She didn't deserve that. Now they've made it worse by putting the wrong person in prison, and the monster is probably still out there. And he didn't have that reaction, and that I find worrying.
Right.
But even more worrying is if you have a close brush with something awful that affects you. And as I told Mike, I have a personal experience with that because my mother was very nearly on one of the flights flown into the Twin Towers in 9/11. And at the last minute changed her flight and just missed out on this horrible situation. And Leonard Mosley is saying he's in the same position because he's telling you, yeah, I would have gone over there, but at the last minute there was this change in my work schedule and I couldn't get my work clothes. And so that's why I wasn't there when the murderer arrived. Okay, well, what that means is, I mean, surely it would play on your mind in those moments where you are in downtime or you've had a bad dream. You would think, like, wow, if only I'd kept to my normal schedule, I'd have been there. And maybe the two people would have changed this person's mind when they showed up. They wouldn't want to tackle two people, or between the two of us, we could have fought him off. Or, whoa, man, I'm barely missed out on being murdered myself. And to just have no, like, well, yeah, okay, I just have to get my work clothes, no big deal. That just seems wrong.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. And some of them, I think, can go either way. I'll go back to the beginning. You talked about the misogyny. Yeah, I definitely noticed that too. And on a couple of different occasions, you know, when, you know, he said, oh, you know how women are, they go through your stuff, and kind of blamed the pregnancy on Angela telling him that she couldn't get pregnant, but then following that up with, well, you know, I should have been smarter and protected myself. But he's got some, what I noticed more so, because he may just be a misogynist. I mean, this may be his personality, he just could be an asshole. But he had some things that severely contradicted that, which was what I found more odd. So he says things like that. But at the same time, he's talking about what a strong woman Elnora is and how someone would have to be, you know, really strong to get the upper hand on her, and really, talking about her. I was listening thinking, like, he's talking about her in a way that I would talk about my wife, Becky. You know, that you know, I respect her as a woman and as a person, and, I see her as a strong, both strong-willed and strong-bodied individual. So it was like these. For me, it's like, well, which one of those is not really his personality? That's what I, when I see such broad things that are on complete opposite ends of the spectrum like that coming from the same person, you know, it leads me to believe that it's very possible that one of those was fabricated. One of those is how he really feels, and the other one is the way he's trying to present himself as feeling. So, I agree. Well, sorry, go ahead.
I would suspect that this is the misleading rather than his genuine opinion of women, that the misogyny is probably more the real opinion. And the reason for that is all of his answers seem to set up, well, there's no reason I could have done this. So his big misogyny comes out first against Margie Dews. Then when you don't seem to take the bait, that's a ridiculous story that, oh yeah, my grown-up son suggested, can I sleep with you? And she said no. So I'm going to go kill her. I mean, that happens all the time. That's just crazy. So
right.
He applies this to her. And then when you don't buy it, then he comes up with the, well, yeah, Elnora could have fought it. Okay, that does seem to contradict, except that given the complete absence of empathy for Elnora, well, yeah, she was really strong and powerful. But I'm not really that bothered that her murderer wasn't convicted. I just didn't bother that my taxpayer buddy is going to pay out an innocent man that shouldn't have been convicted.
Right. Yeah. And I noticed a few different things emotionally from him. One is exactly like you said, that he didn't seem to have empathy towards her. You know, he never really sounded like, man, I miss her. It was terrible. I mean, it was, and when you listen carefully at the beginning of the interview, I don't think I put all of the intro into the episode, but I think I said that what I had asked him at the very beginning was, I'm doing a story about these crimes in Smith County. I'm working on the Elnora Griffin's murder case. And I'm talking to you because I wanted to know if I could get some background on Elnora. And then immediately he started telling me who he thought did it. It was Margie, and they didn't get everybody involved. Like, he never did tell me about Elnora, which was the actual question that I asked him. In regards to what you said, how, you know, he supposedly loved her and was going to marry her, but didn't bother to find out how she was killed, I again, as I've said in a previous call and on the show last week, was that, you know, I find it hard. I don't know that he didn't know, but I find it hard to believe. But as far as him not finding the cause of death, the way he presented it, he could have thought also that he did know the cause of death. You know what I mean? Where if he was told or thought that she was strangled, that could be why he wasn't, you know, looking further into it, because he thought that he did know how she was killed. Is a possibility, just playing, you know, devil's advocate and looking at it from both ways. But yeah, you would think that when you compare that again, and I said this in another call too, that he knew such intimate, specific details about the crime. You know, that the car seat was pulled all the way back and the car was pulled all the way forward. The meal was still on the stove. It just seems really unlikely to me that he would know all of that and not know that her throat was slit. As far as
the weird details that would be if you were outside. So he knew about the towel, he knew the car and the seat was back. But then he also reacted the same way about the phone cord. And I find that equally unbelievable. They'll be, oh, I had no idea the phone was yanked off the wall. That's new to me. I never heard. You would have thought, given how we know David Dobbs presents cases, that's a detail anybody in the area would be associated with. That if you personally were associated with the victim, people would constantly be coming up to you, hey, did you hear that latest news story that says this? Right. So it's just not credible that even if he didn't make an effort to find the details himself, that people wouldn't come up to him, hey, I know you're associated, you heard you testified at that case where that woman got her throat slit. It just looks like all the details are presented, so it builds an alibi as opposed to, it just strikes me that you'd be more reflective. I also heard people saying this. I don't know if it's true. There's no reflection. He gave you just a very, oh, no, this is true. Really? It's not true?
Right.
No, that's not simple.
Yeah. And I noticed too, when you mentioned the empathy, that, yeah, like I said, that he didn't show empathy towards Elnora. But the other thing that I found very odd was I told him, and some of that was off, that was cut out of the interview for time's sake. But I mean, I directly told him that Francis Johnson told me that he thought that Leonard killed her. And what I expected out of that was that he would be angry. I mean, if somebody came to me and told me that Mike told them that I killed someone, I would be pissed at Mike. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, his reactions weren't, it just, and I don't know, I'm not an expert in this field, but it was odd to me that he had no empathy towards Elnora. And it was even odder to me that he didn't have any anger towards a man that supposedly accused him of murder, which was, you know, was fabricated by me just to get a reaction. But I found that very strange. And then, like you said, the being kind of a near miss for him, just the whole thing with the dinner on the stove and all that, like I would expect some kind of survivor's guilt, something more of a reaction there and something to more concrete those memories into his mind, because he was, you know, if he's innocent, then he just by a fluke coincidence managed not to be there when the murderer was there. Somehow he has.
How you could not react to that just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Because if you come with a close brush, you know, if a lorry nearly runs you off the road or a tree falls down, right, you remember that because you personally had a very, that grumbling you hear behind you are my dogs, or they hear a cat fight out of the street. So I apologize for the noise in the background.
That's all right. Yeah, I agree with that he really, you'd think that would concrete it more. But then again, it also may play into, if he truly is kind of a misogynistic person, he may not have cared either. You know, like, you know, because I try to look at this through the lens of, what if he's innocent and he's saying these things, and what if he's guilty if he's saying these things? If he's innocent and we compare the other statements, you know, someone who is truly a misogynist just sees women as a lesser class of person, and it may not have affected him. He obviously, you know, he had two different women at the same time that we know of, and he obviously didn't respect either one of them to be doing the things that he was doing. So, you know, it could play into that. But
it could play into that. But even as a misogynist, though, I just don't see how, if you knew nothing and you had no association at all with the crime, the near miss thing would not in any way resonate with you, because that's also not something he said in the trial, apparently, either, though we don't have the complete transcript, so we don't know that for certain. Well, but do, I'm sure he would have said if he thought of it.
We do have the complete trial transcripts, and no, he didn't. I've yet to hear him say, man, I should have been there. If I was there, she wouldn't get killed. But then again, what we don't have are his police interviews, which we should be getting here mm-hmm. very soon. All right, Kimberly. Well, I want to thank you again for calling in, especially after midnight all the way from the UK. I'm going to let you take care of those dogs and get to bed. But thanks again for calling in, and hopefully we'll talk to you again next time.
That's great. Thank you for all your wonderful work.
You're welcome. Thanks, Bye. Kimberly. Bye. All right, I'm on the air with Jennifer from New York. How are you doing today, Jennifer?
Great, Bob. How are you?
Doing really well. How are you? You already told me you're doing great.
I'm good. Thank you.
All right.
I'm going to jump into it.
Okay. Let's hear it.
So, commenting on, you had said that your initial reaction to the interview that you thought that Mosley was innocent. And usually I tend to agree with you. Although on this point, my initial reaction was that I felt like he thought he was pretty slick. I got the overall impression that he was trying to get away with something, not necessarily quote unquote, the murder, but I thought he had an overall knowledge that was more than what he presented. And at the end of the day, I don't necessarily think he did it. However, I think he's trying really hard to make sure that he keeps the spotlight off of himself.
Okay. Well, what was there anything specific that made you feel that way?
Yeah, there were a couple of things. Number one, I don't see any way how he possibly could not know the cause of death, number one, with the amount of people that he was in contact with that knew Elnora personally. That was a big one for me.
Okay.
Also, too, he knew so many details, like the location of the car, the semen on the body and the bed. And when he questioned if it was in the body, I thought that was a bit of a cocky statement on his point, no pun intended. because he knew that oral sex was performed. I could be wrong, because like I said, I don't know necessarily whether or not he's a murderer, but I just, there were so many things, like he couldn't remember if his child lived in the house, but yet he could specifically remember what time on a Friday he went to work. I just thought that was all very odd.
Yeah, there was a lot of oddities there in you know, what he had said about the semen. When I said that there was semen on her body, you know, he just kind of nonchalantly said, if there was semen on her body, then there should have been semen in her body. You know, I hadn't really thought right. about that if he, you know, happened to know that there wasn't semen in her body. And another thing that I had pointed out to me from several listeners this week that I had kind of missed was, you know, or he had said that, well, if there's semen on her, but you know, semen on the scene, then that's normal because I'm her boyfriend. But then later said that, well, that's not mine. You can stop saying if that's not mine. But then a couple people pointed out to me, I went back and listened, and they were right. He was saying if there was semen in the bedroom, that would be normal. But when I said there was semen on her body, that's when he said, no, that's not mine. There was no semen on the body. But then again, I wonder, he didn't have any concern about semen being in her or in the bedroom, but semen on her, that's where he was like, no, that's, I know for a fact that's not mine. But I wonder if he, you know, again, as I've said in other calls, trying to look at it through two lenses, one looking at it if he is innocent and another if he is guilty. And, you know, if he is guilty, if you're looking at it through, you know, that hypothesis, then maybe it was a the risk of sounding gross, a pull-out situation, or like you said, an oral right. sex or something like that, and not aware of the fact that if her body brushed against wherever that semen was, that it would then be on her body. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure, you know, and I get what you mean by he thinks he's being really slick, I think is how you put it. And
yeah,
again, it just depends on how, you're looking, what I've said to several people this week as I've been discussing the case, and I'm bringing in more experts. I've got Stanley Burke, who is an FBI statement analysis expert. He was actually on the JonBenet Ramsey show with Jim Clemente, as well as Jim Fitzgerald, who was also on that show in, is a forensic linguistic analyst. They're going to be analyzing the statement too, to give us a little better opinion. Cause all I keep thinking is one of two things is true. Either he's telling the truth, or if he's lying, he is a very good liar. He's a convincing liar. And I don't know if he's just, you know, if he's a sociopathic type of person who is very manipulative and a good liar, or if he's telling the truth. Cause it's kind of got, there's like no gray area in the middle there with him. You know,
Yeah, it's pretty hard to tell, but I feel like in the same respect, he's had over 20 years to perfect his story. And the fact that you mentioned that Francis Johnson's brother was the one that did his concrete. He knows you've been looking for him. You were not a surprise. And I feel like he knew from the beginning exactly who you were. And the thing that clued me into that was that you went and you knocked on his door and if I remember correctly, forgive me if I'm wrong, you rifled around the area on your way back to the car and you were almost there and he came out. I just kind of got the sense that he was trying to collect himself to present himself, for lack of a better term, innocent as he could.
I wonder that too, because, I had went twice, and the first time I was there, I knocked on the door several times, no answer, was yelling for him, no answer, walked around back to the barn. And of course I'm yelling, you know, Mr. Mosley the whole time, because, you know, I'm out in the middle of the country and I'm just some strange guy walking around. I didn't want to get shot, and knocked on the door some more and left. Well, and I noted all the vehicles that were there, and there's a big pickup truck that I assumed was his. Seat was pushed pretty far up in it, would seem to fit his height. And so I left, and then the next day I come back again, the exact same vehicles are in the driveway. I knock on the door several times. This time the main door is open, only the storm door is closed. Knocked on that several times. I'm hollering into the house that I'm there. No response. Walk around back, same thing, come back out. And then I'm wondering, are any of these vehicles his? So I was actually taking with my foot and brushing out the tire tracks out of the dirt so that if we came back later, that we would have, a better idea if a vehicle had pulled out and left since we'd been gone.
Right.
So I was there for a good 20 minutes and then got into the car. We were talking in the car for a little. Speaking of which, I guess this is a good time to address. I was waiting for someone to ask, and I can't believe no one has yet. The voice that you heard at the end of the podcast, the creepy voice that was in your right ear, I had several.
The funny thing is, I didn't hear that.
I didn't totally either when I was editing, because when I do the final edit, I Mike did the final editing on most of it, but I did the interview, and I don't do that on with headphones. I do it on my computer. I'm in a soundproof studio. I don't need headphones to hear it. And I didn't hear it until I was up north at my cabin in the middle of the woods with no computer or internet when my Twitter started blowing up on my phone this weekend. But what it was, I had several, you know, the first day I went, I had Jason's a guy from Tyler that I've gotten to know there that went with me. And then the second trip, he wasn't available, but I had four other people that went with me just to kind of watch out for me. And what had happened was, as Mr. Mosley and I were finishing up our conversation, a minivan came pulling in with tinted windows. And apparently one of the passengers in the Yukon was a little paranoid because they started saying, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. Who's that? Stop talking. Stop talking. But it was what had happened was when I got back into the truck, I had a wireless mic on and I took my mic off and set it on the dashboard of the truck. And then when he came out, I went out with a different mic and forgot that one was still on recording in its own track. And that's what that was. So anybody that hasn't seen I tried to respond to emails, but there was just too many of them, and on Twitter and Facebook.
Well, I saw you put out big attentions to everybody about it, and that's what made me go back and listen. I listened six times and I couldn't hear it.
Yeah, it's about the 36 minute mark. If you have your headphones in, you'll hear it in your right ear, and it is creepy. It sounds like, because, you know, people were like, what? Did you have a microphone pointed at the house and someone was in the house whispering to him to stop talking, or what was that? But it was, unfortunately, it was nothing really that exciting. It was just my dumbass left the microphone on the truck, and one of my passengers was paranoid.
I do have one quick logistical question, if you know the answer.
Okay.
How, I know Francis Johnson was 5'10" and Ed was 6'7". How tall is Leonard Mosley?
I don't have an exact height. He was taller than I thought he was, but he was wearing jeans that were kind of coming down over the bottom of his shoe, because I was wondering, he looked to me to be about 5'6", maybe, when he was standing there talking to me.
Okay, because I did see a picture of him, and I thought he looked fairly short.
Yeah, he did to me, too, in the pictures.
Yeah, but however, with her being 4'4", it wouldn't take somebody, and again, I'm not implicating him and I'm not saying it's him, but it wouldn't take anybody incredibly over 5 feet to be able to overpower somebody who's 4'4" and 104 pounds.
No.
So I just thought that his argument on that front was not the best argument he could have presented. But like I said, I just feel like he remembered things that would take the spotlight off of him, and then he kind of was blurry on the details that in what could be his estimation didn't really matter.
Yeah.
That was my ultimate conclusion from all of it.
Yeah, and I noticed the same thing. Well, hey, Jennifer, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. You made some good points and some good questions, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain the mystery voice while you're on the line.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Have a good evening.
You too. Take care, Jennifer.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. You were on the air with Truth and Justice. Mike tells me that you wanted to remain anonymous, so we'll call you Mrs. Anonymous. What, did you have a question for me?
Thanks so much, Bob. Yeah, long-time listener. Listen from the beginning. Really appreciate getting in today. Hope all is going good so far with these calls. I have so many questions, but I think the most salient one is what you thought of the fact that Mosley, he was basically dodging your question. You first mentioned him not seeing, him saying in the trial that he hadn't seen her for, 2 weeks. He dodged it. Then you came back and specified that their semen was a fresh puddle, and he immediately started dodging it, and that's when he made the comment that, well, you know, whoever killed her must have been smart in order to get away with it. And you mentioned that it was out of context, and I agree, but what troubled me is what I think he said leading up to it. It's not leading up to it, but, or directly following, but within that same set of statements, he reasoned with you as though you would, you know, obviously reason the same way, that anybody who was stupid enough to have at first raped her is going to not want to go to jail and is just going to want to kill her. But he said it in the third person until he got to the statement where he said, I don't want to go back to the pen, so I'm going to end this. And he changed it into the first person and then went back to the third person. And I know you've worked with Jim Clemente on analyzing linguistics, and I don't know if that stuck out to you at all or if that caught your attention.
It didn't. Actually, I hadn't even noticed it until you just said that. So I'm going to have to take your word for it for the moment until I have a chance to go back and review that. I do remember that part of the conversation. I remember him saying that if you go in and you know, you rape somebody, and I remember him saying that, you know, you don't want to go back to the pen, but I guess I didn't notice that he, so you're saying he had switched up the, to first person then and said, I don't want to go back to the pen, or I don't want, you know, I'm going to end this.
He said, I don't want to go back to the pen. I'm going to stop it. And okay. Has he been in the pen? I mean, had he been to prison?
Not that I'm aware
before?
Of.
Before?
No, I've looked at his criminal record and I haven't seen that he ever has.
Okay. Well, you know, the other thing, so I've studied graphology, handwriting analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you look for when you see something kind of out that is an outlier. But another thing you look for, and that I noticed in his interview, is when you get a really good sample of handwriting, it usually is at least one full page of writing.
Right.
And if you apply that to the interview, the same principle, I think, would stand, which is that what somebody writes at the end of the sample is more telling than what they write throughout, you know, from the beginning through the middle. And that's because it's harder to hold on to whatever you're projecting through to the end. And it's right. more revealing, you know, in terms of their subconscious. So when he thinks that he's off the hook and he's convinced you, you know, that he's this innocent guy and you guys are both friends and you appreciate his brickwork at his house and, you know, thanks so much. That's when he sticks in, oh yeah, well, by the way, I knew about you investigating this for the last 3 months.
Right.
And that to me just, it really stuck out as, you know, his subconscious just telling on himself.
Yeah,
among other things. I did write several things in an email, but I don't know if you noticed that. Either if you felt like that carried more weight, the fact that he stuck it in at the end.
Yeah, I did actually a little bit, and I'm glad you said that. And what a cool job, and that you're the first person that's mentioned that you caught on to that. But that's precisely why during the conversation, you know, I told him several times. I don't remember how much of this was in because I cut a lot of myself talking out. But where I had told him that, I don't believe this. I think that you're innocent. You know, when I was telling him that Francis had accused him of the murder. You know, I was, you know, what I was saying that was that part was off the air was, you know, but, you know, I don't believe that. I know you're innocent. And it's specifically why I interjected the comment about the brickwork was very much to make him feel at ease and to make him feel like, okay, this is becoming a comfortable conversation now. It's the same thing that I do when even as it, you know, it's something that's an interrogation technique, but it's also something that I do when I interview people on the podcast, because people sit in front of a microphone and they get freaked out. So I try to loosen them up and get their mind off of it to get them to forget that the microphones are there. And this guy was kind of using the same technique. So that's awesome that you picked up on it. I will go back and listen to that. All right. Well, Mrs. Anonymous, thank you so much for calling in, and I hope you have a great night.
Thank you so much. You're doing a great job. Have a good night.
Bye-bye. You too. Thanks. Bye.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
All right, we're back from our break, and I'm on the line with Allie from Ohio. How are you doing today, Allie?
Great. Hi, Bob. So I'm going to jump right into my question because I know you're going through a lot of these. But I wanted to know if you had picked up on Leonard saying that he went to Eleanor's house on Friday when the police were there. And I thought that that was really intuitive whether or not he knew the cause of death. I thought that was really strange that he said he showed up, you know, the night that they were there. But how would you not know the cause of death? So I didn't know if you heard that in the interview as well.
I did hear it, and I did know that just from the trial testimony, but actually I hadn't thought much about it until you just pointed that out, that, yeah, he was on the scene with Johnny Pryor, who had found the body and noted that there was blood yeah. everywhere that night. That's a really, really good observation.
Yeah, I mean, I know there wasn't blood on the pillow underneath her, but the the rest of the house had blood. And even if he didn't look in and see, if he was there with Johnny and the police and all of the hustle and bustle that must have been going on, it just seems so unlikely that he would not know the cause of death.
Well, right. I mean, you had Johnny who saw and noted that she saw that there was blood everywhere. And she right. told that, and Ed's grandmother was there with her when that happened. Kubia was there on the scene that night. They would have been talking about it. You had not only all of the detectives and the other deputies that were there working on the scene, but you had the volunteer firemen, you had the EMTs. The idea that no one on that scene would have said anything about the fact that there was blood everywhere or her throat was slit, it does seem very unlikely now that you bring it up.
Yeah, I think that when I heard that, and honestly, I didn't put it together until later on when you said he went through two trials, how else does he not know? And then I thought, he was at the scene. And I went back and I listened again. And I didn't know it was in the trial testimony. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know how you'd be on the scene not know that or see it or hear it from someone.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. That's a great point. So, hey, Allie, thank you so much for calling in. You've given us a lot more to think about. I very, very much appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. I am on the air with Ramona from Nashville, Tennessee. How are you doing today, Ramona?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing really, really well. So Mike tells me you have a question for me about voicemail.
I do. So do we know what time that voicemail was left?
You're talking about the voicemail that Leonard Mosley left saying that he was coming over that night?
Yes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes. Due to the stellar investigative work by Detective Waller, we don't. He testified at trial that there was a message on the answering machine that said that he would be over there later that night, or said that he would be over there later. And then he said that he doesn't remember what time the call came in, doesn't know what time the call came in, or anything like that. So, and of course, he didn't write it in his report. So unfortunately, all we know is that the voicemail was there. Now, when I mentioned it to Leonard, I don't know if you caught, Leonard did confirm that he did leave that message. You know, I said, well, you left her the message saying you were coming over that night on a answering machine. And he said, yeah. But no, the answer to your question is we do not know what time that call came in.
Did they ever check her phone bill to see if he had actually called so many times as he claimed?
So they kind of checked her phone bill. From what I have, I don't know, just from what was presented at trial, it only shows long distance calls that she made. Doesn't have any local incoming or outgoing calls on her records that they obtained or that they presented at trial. And they claimed at trial that they couldn't get local records, which is not true. I know several other cases where they did obtain local phone records, but that's what they claimed. So yeah, there's just, again, stellar police work. We are left with more questions than answers, unfortunately.
That's very interesting. I would have assumed they would have at least checked on the time of the voicemail, but it doesn't really surprise me at this point in time.
Well, considering they seem to have deleted that voicemail off the tape, I don't think they were real interested in it.
Yeah. Well, I have many questions for you, Bob, but I know everyone else is trying to get in. So thank you so much for all that you do. I enjoy your show every week. Keep up the good work.
Great. Thank you so much for calling, Ramona. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep. Have a good night. Bye. All right. I'm on the air with Caitlin from Baltimore, Maryland. How are you doing tonight, Caitlin?
Hi. It's so good to talk to you.
You too. Mike, you're calling in the, you know, in the end of the night. So Mike says you had a whole list of things that we've already covered, but he said you had a really good point or a question regarding the relationship status between Angela and Leonard and Elnora. So what do you have for us?
I did. I have a couple things. Towards the end, you were saying that Angela's friend said that Angela and Leonard were dating. And then I was thinking that might be what Angela told her friend, but that doesn't always mean that that's true. I feel like especially if she was having a child or had a child, she could have thought that they were dating or she could have wanted them to be dating. But if it was just coming from her friends and her, I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know how much of that I believe.
Yeah, a few people have brought that up that, you know, just because, you know, and I think somebody put it really well in an email. One of the listeners had said that two people can be in a relationship, but be in two different relationships where they both have two different ideas mm-hmm. of what the relationship is. Angela, mm-hmm. at trial, the thing that caught me was Angela testified at trial, you know, and she's under oath, and she said that she had mm-hmm. been living with Leonard for 2 years and that she had, she had moved out. Sounded like it was because of Elnora, because he was cheating. And then she was living with a friend, and that she said that he asked her to move back in, and she told him that he needed to make a choice, and he did, so she moved
that's
in.
That's right.
So it's to me, I mean, it's still a possibility, but it's very different just chatting with your friends about your relationship and sitting in a courtroom on a witness stand under oath and describing your relationship that way. And that's the one point to me that is not really so much up for conjecture if she's telling the truth, which we don't know, you know, as opposed to, you know, just I think that the relationship is more serious than he does. This is very different. Mm-hmm. If she's saying specifically he wanted her to move back in, she told him that he had to choose between her and Elnora. I mean, that's a pretty specific set of circumstances for him to not understand that they're in a relationship.
Yeah, I get that. I think that makes sense. And then I forgot that she had lived with him and then moved out and moved back in, because when he was talking about her living there, he said that either said she was pregnant or he said that the baby was already there. Which one did he say first?
Well, he wasn't real sure. He flip-flopped. At first he said the baby wasn't born yet. And then when he thought mm-hmm. about it, and I told him that the murder was in 93, and then he thought about his son's birthday, it was 92, he says, so then that would mean the baby was there, but he says
that's
he doesn't.
Right. He was like, well, he must have been born then.
Right. But then, I found it odd that he said, I don't remember the baby ever being here. So it makes me wonder, was the baby staying with someone else? Was he just completely oblivious to what she was doing with the child? I don't know.
And I wonder if he was misremembering the time period too, if he was remembering a time when she was pregnant and she was there and, you know, she's saying she ran up the phone bill and she did this and that. Well, I wonder if that was the year before when she was still pregnant and then he wasn't actually telling you about or remembering the time she had the baby, which would be the same time that a murder happened.
That's a good point. That could very well be the case.
I don't know. Well, it was a really interesting conversation. Yeah, some other things that I told Mike are some of the things you guys talked about, but I kind of had the same impression as you, where he's either the best liar I've ever heard or he really has nothing to do with it.
Right. And I'm to be honest, I'm still in that same boat with it. I feel like it's got to be one or the other, and I'm not ready to make a determination on which it is yet. But Caitlin, I want to thank you for calling in and for your input. Hope things mm-hmm. are going well out there in Baltimore.
They are. Thanks so much. It was so good to talk to you.
You too. Have a great night.
You too. Bye.
Bye. All right. We got time for one more call. All right. I am on the air with Stephanie from South Carolina. And Stephanie, I hear that you're currently in the Atlanta airport.
I am. I had to call.
Well, I'm glad you did, because Mike told me that you have a question about one of Leonard Mosley's responses, and it's a question that I've had several people email in about too, so it'd be a good chance to address it. So what did you want to ask me?
Absolutely. So when you mentioned that Elnora's throat was actually slit, and that's how she died, a few lines later in the interview, he makes a comment about there's blood everywhere, or blood on the crime scene everywhere, something along those lines. And it stopped me in my tracks, because I thought, well, how did he know there was blood everywhere? He's acting like he didn't see the crime scene and didn't know this.
Right. Right.
That's my question.
Yeah. And that's a good, I'm glad you asked it, because it's a question that other people had. You know, there was parts in there where I cut a lot of me talking out so we could hear just Mosley. And like I said, some of the stuff was strategical stuff that I'm not sure strategical is a word, strategic stuff that was, some legal strategy stuff. And some of it was just, like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I had, in order to try to get a response out of Leonard, I had told him that Francis Johnson had accused him of the murder. And that was to get a response out of him. So, and I cut a lot of that stuff out so we could just hear how he was talking in that part. Cause I had a few people say, well, how did he know there's blood everywhere? You never said that. I did say that right before that clip. I had just cut that whole part out. I was explaining that I'm trying to remember exactly what I said, but it was something along the lines that, you know, Francis says that he walked in and saw her laying there with blood everywhere after he left or something like that.
Gotcha.
And so that's where that came from. Yeah, that was from something that I had said, but it was off the air.
Well, thank you for clearing that up.
No problem. And I hope you have you're at the airport now, so you must be going somewhere.
Yeah, I'm going to visit some family.
All right. Well, I hope you have a very nice, safe flight. And thank you so much for calling in, Stephanie. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Keep up the strong work, Bob. You're doing great.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, that was our last phone call for the night, and for all of you that called in and got through, I want to thank you, and I know the whole time I was taking these calls, the voicemail was going crazy, so I know lots and lots of you were trying to get in. Hopefully, a lot of you will be able to get in next time. I love hearing from all of you. You guys added a lot of insight and had a lot of great questions for me. There were, however, a couple of questions that I thought would come up that didn't that I do want to address in this episode. The first one was something that I noticed after recording last week's episode when I continued to review the interview. I realized later that Leonard Mosley had repeatedly said that on the Friday after the murder that he had been calling Elnora all morning and all day, and that when he got off work he went and drove by her house about 3:30 in the afternoon. What hadn't occurred to me before, but I realize now, is that Elnora would have been at work all day Friday, if she was alive. And Leonard Mosley knew that. So if she was supposedly at work and he had no idea anything had happened to her, why would he be calling her house all morning and day when he knows that she's not home? And why would he drive by at 3:30 in the afternoon when he knows that she's not home from work yet at that point? And if he did think that something had happened to her and he was really concerned, then when he continued to call her house with no answer, why wouldn't he then call her work to see if she was there? After all, that's where she was supposed to be that day. This entire story about him trying to call her all day when he knew that she wasn't home is a giant red flag to me. And then we did have one other question that came in through Twitter during the call-ins. Carrie Weaver on Twitter says, was Mosley right or left-handed? Homework with the kids, no time to call tonight. Well, Carrie, I totally get the homework with the kids thing, but I'm glad you took the time to tweet me that question because it's a good question. You all heard at the end of the interview, I asked Leonard Mosley to write down his phone number. I'm sure some of you picked up on the fact that the reason I asked him to write it down is because I wanted to see if he was right or left-handed. And that's the big question that's come up. You remember back when we looked at the crime scene analysis at the beginning, it appears that Elnora's throat was slit with someone's left hand. The assumption there being that the killer was probably left-handed. Now, we don't know that for certain. The killer could have been holding her with their strong hand and cut her throat with their weak hand, or vice versa. But as I said back then, it seems like the most likely scenario would be that it would be someone who is left-handed. And the answer to the question that everyone has been wondering about for these last several months, including myself, is Leonard Mosley left or right-handed? And the answer is, he's right-handed. Truth and Justice is a production of New Beginning Incorporated. I want to give a special thanks to Johnny Rose of Slightly Subversive Music for creating all of the music for the show. Thank you to Tate Krupa for designing and creating our logo. Thank you to our executive producer, Mike Bussing, for screening the calls for the call-in and also doing the final edit on today's podcast. Thank you to today's sponsors, ABC's Conviction, Universal Pictures, A Girl on a Train, and 4Athletics. I also want to take this opportunity to let you all know that we have several new t-shirts up on the Truth and Justice Apparel website. There are a couple of colors with some new Free Ed 8s t-shirts. They use the hashtag Free Ed 8s. We also have a new Kenny Snow t-shirt. It says Free the Blizzard. It has a smiley face with a gold tooth on it. And a new redesign of the Veritas Equitas t-shirt. So go check out all the apparel either by going to our homepage, truthandjusticepod.com, and clicking the shop link. Or you can go directly to the site at truthandjusticeapparel.com. I want to thank you all for all of your support. Your engagements and your opinions mean the world to me. Keep sending in your thoughts, theories, and ideas into theories@truthandjusticepod.com. Send those new cases into cases@truthandjusticepod.com. Like the Facebook page or follow me on Twitter @truthjusticepod. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.